Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you like Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. On November 9th of 2004, a Kenosha police officer fatally shot 21-year-old Michael Bell in the head. That shooting occurred after a traffic stop directly in front of his home while his mother and sister watched in horror. Kenosha police conducted their own investigation. They said it was justified, and then they cleared themselves of wrongdoing within 3 days. Now, since Michael's death, the city of Kenosha settled a federal civil rights lawsuit with the family. The Bells, however, have used those funds to change how police investigate their own. And in April of 2014, Wisconsin became the first state to mandate external investigations associated with police shootings. But has justice been served in the Michael Bell case? Joining us today is the victim's father, Michael Bell Sr.
Hey, Libby, thank you for having me on the show.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Michael, the kind of guy he was, and what happened that night.
He was a 21-year-old son. He was employed. He was going to school. And he was out with friends. Michael was a really easygoing guy and very liked and liked by his friends. And that particular night, he had gone out with friends, and they had a designated driver, and that designated driver became intoxicated. So my son, being the person that he is, says, "Mom, I'm going to drive, and I'm going to get us back safely." That's what I'm assuming that he did, because that's the kind of person I believe him to be. And he ended up going home, and you can see there was a squad car along the way. There was some dash cam footage of him just driving very smoothly, very quietly down a side street to in front of his house. If you look at the dash cam video from that night, you actually see him get out of the car. He turns off the key and gets out of the car. And then at that point, the officer arrives. And then the dash cam video takes over from there.
And what happened?
The officer accused Michael of speeding, and we've proven in court that that did not occur. He accused Michael of running a stop sign, and we know that that didn't occur. So imagine being a 21-year-old guy and all of a sudden being accused of these type of things, and it didn't happen. And then the officer grabbed him, pushed him off camera, and you can hear Michael say things like, "Why are you kicking me?" or whatever. Michael did not take a sobriety test. I think they were asking him for one, and he didn't want one. There was none of this, "Ma'am or sir, can I see your driver's license?" and "Sir, have you been drinking?" It was none of that. It was an initial confrontation that was pretty aggressive.
When did your daughter and Michael's mother come out and see what was going on outside?
Sirens are going off. Lights were in the front of their house. His mother's bedroom was directly over the car. The two of them put on their robes. They ran downstairs. Michael was being tased, and we looked at the taser bursts, and there were very long, very prolonged tasing. And Michael ran to the back of the house, and that's where the ladies that were upstairs got their robes on and ran downstairs and were on this little patio area. And there was a car in back. And they were able to watch Michael being subdued by police officers very violently. And they were things like, "Why are you beating on him?" and those types of things. Michael, at one point, this is what I heard from Mom. His Mom said that at one point, they were raising a commotion, and there was a Lieutenant Kruger that was on scene. He said, "If you don't stop, I'll shoot you." And we believe at that point, Michael got up in defense of his mother and came towards the officers. Michael was eventually bent over a car, his hands cuffed behind his back. This Lieutenant Kruger was holding him in a bear hug. And an officer to Michael's right screamed, "He has my gun." And another officer ran up, placed his gun directly to my son's temple, squeezed the trigger. But because he was pressuring the gun so tightly to my son's head, the gun didn't fire. He pulled the gun away a second time, and he put the gun to my son's head and killed him direct. Shot a bullet right through his head in front of his mother and sister.
How much of the actual shooting is on video?
None, because the dash cam, the squads were parked in the front, and Michael had went towards the back. But it's curious that there were 5 eyewitnesses. There was Michael's mother, Michael's sister, 2 tenants that lived in a duplex next door, and then there was a woman that worked at a nursing home that came out and heard the scuffle. So there were actually 5 eyewitnesses to shooting that weren't law enforcement.
And there were how many police officers there?
At least 4.
How many times was Michael tased?
I don't have that report in front of me. You know, the tasers record the bursts and stuff like that. But I'm going to say he was tased at least 4 times or more.
And when he was actually shot, he was already in handcuffs?
The family saw handcuffs. There were bruises on his wrists that could be either verified as handcuffs or not verified as handcuffs. The officers dispute that the handcuffs were there, and that's one of the points of a contention that we have here.
Did any of the witnesses, non-law enforcement, say that Michael was in any way incapacitated at the time that he was shot?
He was bent over in a car in a bear hug, and he was being held. And that is what we had saw. And eventually, we brought this matter to a really great law firm, and they did really great detective work. And we were able to uncover that the version that the officers created, where an officer went to the front of the car and shot Michael in the head, could not have happened. The forensic examiner stated that their version of the shooting was forensically impossible. It couldn't have happened in any way. And that started the whole ball rolling. We settled a civil rights lawsuit. I refused to accept a non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement, which is unheard of, and they gave it to me. So they settled, and at that time it was $1.75 million, and it was a record for the state of Wisconsin, and our family had the right to continue to tell Michael's story. You have to understand that I'm a retired Air Force pilot, and at the time I was at the rank of major. And I was very pro-law enforcement. I wore a uniform, but then very shortly thereafter, I started finding out really what goes on in local law enforcement.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Once the attorneys got involved and started discovering really what had happened, they knew that the police version of the shooting couldn't work.
Michael Bell tells us why he doesn't think he has the full story of what happened to his son.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Michael Bell, whose son was killed by Kenosha police in 2004. How soon after the shooting were you suspicious that you weren't getting the full story of what went on?
My first time that I really recognized there was a problem was that both of the ladies started raising hell in the community by handing out posters and going up to, like, the Attorney General's Fond du Lac, the city, it was Peg Lautenschlager at the time, and putting posters on cars talking about Michael being murdered. And I kept questioning, why are you doing this, you know? I just couldn't believe that officers could be involved in what they were telling me. But the first time I really knew that there was a problem was slightly before that, but this incident really made it stand out because we were in counseling. I was trying to, how do you keep a family together when one of your family members has been executed and other family members have watched it? And so I'm in counseling and I'm listening to these women grieving in front of the counselors. And I know that this wasn't some contrived story. This was their experience of what they had seen. But the moment that I really knew that there was a problem was the chief of police announced within like 52 hours that the shooting was justified. And I, as an Air Force pilot, knew that there was a problem because, like, I knew that there were eyewitnesses that hadn't even been talked to. And I'm like, how can you come up with a justified ruling when you haven't even gathered all the evidence? And so that was the first indicator that there was a problem. The second indicator that there was a problem was when I watched these ladies really talk about what Michael happened. And then once the attorneys got involved and started discovering really what had happened, they knew right off the bat that the police version of the shooting couldn't work.
I want to go back to that 52-hour period of time after the actual shooting. You said the police were cleared in that period. Who was doing the investigation?
The co-workers of the police that were involved.
So they're friends and co-workers?
Friends and co-workers. You go barbecue with your co-workers on the weekend at a local park. You go bowling with them or whatever. Those were the people that were clearing that. And I'm like, there's just no way. If I'm a pilot and I have an accident in the military, my squadron commander doesn't investigate me. You know, my training office doesn't investigate me. It has to be an outside agency.
Yet in 2004, that was not the case in
the
state of Wisconsin.
That was not the case, yeah. And I had brought in a researcher, and we had found that for 100 years prior to that, no police department had ever found its own shooting unjustified, ever.
And you challenged that then?
I challenged that, and I used that data to talk to legislators that said we shouldn't be investigating ourselves because look at the impossible history of perfection that's occurring here. And this is just going to create additional hardship for the rest of society.
And you were very instrumental in changing that law.
I think I was the spearhead. I really am. I met with other families, and we did a lot of things. That $1.75 million settlement, I used my entire portion of that to go ahead and fund legislation. And in 2014, Governor Scott Walker signed the first bill in the nation that said our police departments will not investigate themselves after a police-involved killing.
All right. So you did receive a federal civil settlement. You did manage to change the law, not just in Wisconsin, but a lot of other states have since followed suit. Why is it now, 20 years later plus, that you are continuing to cry for justice and say the truth has not yet been revealed?
You know, our attorneys could make certain discoveries, but it was a team of investigators that worked for me that made additional discoveries. And then I pretty much made one of the biggest discoveries myself, that there's no way that their version of the shooting could have happened that way. And the hard evidence shows it. And then when we started taking a look at all the evidence, we had found that there was just so much cover-up that I could not believe it. You know how hard it hurts to be a military officer, to go fly three wars for your country, and come home and have a local government kill your child, and you're treated the way that our family was treated. I keep telling people that if a blonde-haired boy can be killed under a spotlight, and his dad is an Air Force officer with resources, and he can't get a good investigation, nobody can.
What was the first bit of evidence that you found?
Pat Dunphy, who was the attorney in the case at Cannon and Dunphy at the time, very brilliant lawyer, recognized that the autopsy report was never even looked at. It clearly stated that Michael was shot on the right side of the head and a bullet passed on the left side of his head. And the officer's version of the shooting, they placed the officer to Michael's left and they shot him the other way. They had to do that because there's no way an officer can step between another officer and kill somebody when he could have easily just taken his hand off a gun if that was the case. You have to understand that there was no DNA or fingerprints on the gun, and every touch leaves a trace. And we know that that confirms that that didn't happen. But Pat Dunphy had recognized that the officers had lied, and he allowed all four officers to testify under oath. And after the last officer testified, he gave him a copy of the medical examiner's report. And he made him read that statement that the bullet entered right to left. And he said, "Do you still stand by your version of the shooting?" And the officer said, "Yes." And that's when they got caught. That's when it started the downward spiral to a settlement, because they got caught right then and there.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I went up there with a video camera and I started recording every square inch. And then finally, I saw the bullet impact location.
Michael Bell reveals newly discovered evidence in the shooting of his son by Kenosha police.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Michael Bell. Much of the evidence that you had was revealed in that trial. And that's the reason that you won, at the time, the largest settlement of its kind in the state. But since then, you have discovered other things.
I think the biggest thing that we discovered was in 2019, the car sat in its spot, unmoved for 15 years. The grieving mom refused to move that car. And finally, they had sold that property. They had moved out of Kenosha, and the car was moved then. And I made a decision after the car was moved to go and videotape that entire garage, which was on the west side of the shooting. Because if the officer's version of the shooting was right, the bullet could have went to the east. But if the eyewitness version of the shooting was right, the bullet had to go towards that garage. And so I went up there with a video camera and I started recording every square inch. I'd go up and down, and I moved from south to north. And then finally, I saw the bullet impact location. My daughter at the time was telling a news reporter exactly how Michael was bent over and in a bear hug. And I was able to, 15 years later, find a bullet impact location. And I was able to superimpose it upon my daughter's head, which aligns up perfectly with all the evidence. And so that's what we had. We had the bullet impact location. And I went to the nation's leading forensics expert and I said, what's going on here? And he, in his methodical way, tested the whole area for lead and found out that that particular cavity that we had found, which lined up perfectly with the other evidence, tested positive for lead. He said, we need to see the bullet. The bullet will tell us everything. I asked the city for the bullet and refused to release it. I asked the city chief of police to release it, and he refused to release it. I went in front of this common council, and I said, I offered to indemnify this city of any financial risk if you release that bullet, and he refused to do it. I went to the community then afterwards, because they refused to do so, and I offered them $100,000 to local charity if they released that bullet, and they refused to do so. I upped it to $200,000. They refused to do so. In November of 2024, we were able to actually see the outside of the bullet container, and we were able to recognize that that bullet was tampered with just 2 days prior to them giving under oath testimony for that civil rights lawsuit. And they had checked it out and had looked at it 2 days prior. And they still won't give up the bullet as we speak at this moment.
Why is it important to you to have that bullet investigated? What do you think it's going to show you that you don't already know?
I think the bullet is going to show a number of things. Number one, do we know if that's even the real bullet? Because we saw evidence that showed that we saw the evidence marker show the bullet in multiple locations. I mean, we're talking bullets that are in multiple locations. You got an evidence marker here, and you can look at concrete lines and says the bullet is 1 inch away. And all of a sudden, now I have another evidence marker, and a bullet is a foot away. And then we look at the bullet from different angles. And then the police came back and said, well, that bullet impact location could have been caused by something else. We didn't see it in the crime scene photos from that night. I went to a computer forensic scanner here in the city of Milwaukee, Data Narrow, and they ran a pixel scan of the photos from the night of the shooting. And guess what? That bullet impact location was there. But the problem was is because the car was so close to the edge of this garage that at any level you couldn't see it. But when that car was pulled away, I was able to do a scan at a lower level, and I was getting down on my knees and then looking up, and there it was. It was about 18 inches off the ground, and it aligned perfectly with every version of the shooting. Where the bullet casing landed, where Michael was shot through the head, with my daughter's demonstration, it aligned everything, and it showed there's a perpetual cover-up that's continuing to this day between law enforcement and the city of Kenosha, and they won't make this right.
Why do you think they won't let you have that bullet? It's been over 20 years since the shooting.
Because it's going to implicate the mayor. It's going to implicate the then chief of police. It's going to implicate the DA at the time for not doing the job properly.
In what way will it implicate them? What is it that either you suspect or that you know that they did?
They know that they covered up the shooting, and they created this false narrative, and they don't want to get busted doing so. And somehow or another, they knew all about this. Instead of doing the right thing, they covered it up. And the only thing that they could do now is continue to cover it up.
Do you believe that any evidence was tampered with?
Yes, I do. I believe the bullet was tampered with. Why did they want to see that bullet a day prior? Why, under oath, did these officers refuse to acknowledge that they had looked at that bullet the day prior? We had found out. It was really an interesting story. Erin Moriarty from CBS 60 Minutes came into Kenosha, and she wanted us to show her what we thought had occurred. And it was a Nissan Pulsar, and it had a very thin driver's side mirror. And it was very thin. And the officer had backed up, had hooked his gun on a car mirror. He had what was called a jacket gap on his utility belt. And that it's during cold months, you could take your jacket and slide it between your holster and your utility belt so you can stay warm, but you can still access your weapon. And this officer had backed up, and then he had hooked his gun on this car mirror, and then when he had turned, he had felt somebody was grabbing his gun. I believe that officer, who later committed suicide in 2010, I believe he honestly thought that my son was taking his gun, but was not the case. But instead of coming back and said, we made an honest mistake, which I as a military officer can accept, they decided to fabricate a story, and that story continues to this day. And that's why we've done all the things that we've done.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
For 8 minutes, we have an audio recording of him confronting me about my son being killed. He was pleading for me to stop asking questions.
Michael Bell tells how he was confronted by a former Kenosha police officer who killed his son.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Michael Bell, whose son was killed by Kenosha police officers more than 20 years ago. In all those years, again, we're talking 2004 to today, have you had any personal one-on-one contact with any of the officers that were involved in that shooting?
Yes. I think it was maybe 2017. I had went in front of the police and fire commission. I had called for an investigation into the shooting, as I did all that time, so nobody would change my words. I carried a small digital microphone in my pocket. And as I and one of the investigators on my team were leaving that police and fire commission meeting, the officer who killed my son, Albert Gonzalez, approached me and started talking to me and confronted me about my son. And you can see this on our YouTube channel. Gonzalez confronted me, and for 8 minutes, we have an audio recording of him confronting me about my son being killed. He was pleading for me to stop asking questions. When I questioned him about the officer that took his own life, Eric Strausbaugh, he started, "How dare you do this?" And then eventually, that officer wrote an unauthorized book on the matter. Well, he was a police officer.
And on the
he was
shooting.
On the shooting. Well, he was working for the city on duty. We have testimony of this. He wrote a book, and he self-published it and called it A Fateful 2 Minutes. And he talked about the shooting. He identified another officer who is actually running for Kenosha Sheriff right now, James Beller, who was an eyewitness to the shooting, and it was never disclosed in any of the findings from that night. And so he wrote a book, and we filed a libel suit because he definitely libeled us in that book. And based on U.S. Supreme Court law, a local judge should have granted that libel suit, but he dismissed it. He had written things that they were like, I'll bring up exactly the quote that he had said in the book. This is, "Yay, wahoo, I did it. I cheered inside my head as though I scored the winning touchdown. And this is the moment he just killed my child." He had talked about watching the blood pour out of my son's head and that it felt like any deer that he had ever killed. He had just killed a human being, and he had sensed it was just like any deer that he had ever killed. But he
this was in the self-published book?
It was in a self-published book. He never ran it through an attorney. We filed a libel suit about it, and a local pro-law enforcement judge refused to allow it to go forward. And these are the things that have been occurring nonstop since November 2004.
Coming up at WTMJ Conversations.
We went to the human capabilities of non-FBI forensics here in the United States to get to that type of audio.
Michael Bell talks about newly uncovered audio from the night of the shooting.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Michael Bell. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Now, there's other evidence that you've uncovered in the last 20 years, and a lot of it just in the last 5 or 10 years. Tell us about the audio from that night that until recently you didn't know existed.
Back in 2004, science hadn't evolved in forensic audio. And one of the problems that occurred was that the sirens were left on as the dash camcorders were recording. And so you couldn't hear anything because the audio was being washed out by siren noise. And later on, technology had evolved to the point where we could filter out that siren noise, and we can listen to some of the underlying conversation of what the officers were discussing. And it was very difficult to get. Imagine I have the dash cam video, but it only plays in a certain format. And I approached law enforcement and said, "Can we have a copy of this particular software that plays it?" And they refused. And law enforcement refused to assist us in any way. They wouldn't even respond. So we had a very difficult challenge of finding the software, which was now obsolete, so we could play the audio so that way a forensic analyst could listen to it and remove the siren noise, and so we can listen to the underlying conversation. So we found the software engineer in North Carolina. And to this day, if he's out here listening to this, I want to tell you thank you.
What did you hear that you didn't know prior to the discovery of that audio?
Well, I assure you, Libby, that not one of the police reports ever stated that men at the scene, and there were only men at the scene officers, never once did they say, "I'm so sorry." And another officer says, "I feel sorry too." And these are spoken at men's words in the audio dash cam recording. And we want to know the truth. And we went to the FBI. We asked for assistance. I got a little bit of assistance with the FBI here in Milwaukee, and I don't want to discredit them in any way. And I am grateful, and I know that they have a very heavy load. But we went to the human capabilities of non-FBI forensics here in the United States to get to that type of audio.
Was there any DNA evidence that you have since discovered that was not apparent at the time?
If you take a look at the gun, it had what's called a knurled grip. You know, you don't want your gun sliding around so you have a bad shot. So when you grab it, it's very firm, and it has these diamond knurls on there. And there's a lot of them, hundreds of them, on the handle on both sides. And if there was a violent struggle for a weapon, as the officers said that occurred, there would be Michael's DNA all over that gun. And in addition to that, there were certain forensic photos that were not given to us that showed that Michael had open cuts on his hand from other things. You know, like if he was working, you get a paper cut or whatever. And those are big-time DNA shedders. There was no DNA or fingerprints on that gun. Even when Michael had open, like, paper cut sores on his hand that would be shedding DNA all over it. And like I said before, every touch leaves a trace, but we brought this evidence to the local DA, and he completely did not look at it.
What do you mean he didn't look at it?
We brought it to them. We asked them to open an investigation in the matter, and they refused to do so. I brought it to DA Solis just recently, a year ago, and I asked him to open an investigation, and he didn't do it. But I want to tell your listeners, we did go back to DA Solis, and we asked him to pause anything going on, because the city has recently told us that they, when they digitized all their files, they have 17,300 documents that we believe that we did not get most of. And under open records law, we're entitled to that. And we can't wait for the findings. And I'm not going to tell you where we're going to go. But we can't wait for the findings of that, because that's even going to confirm to us even more what kind of things were occurring in the background.
Now, currently, you have something before the appeals court.
We do. And it's interesting that you break that up, because it wasn't that long ago. You know, I took out full-page ads in the New York Times. I took out full-page ads in USA Today. In the Washington Post, I was calling out the misconduct of the Attorney General, Josh Call, here in the state of Wisconsin regarding this matter, because we brought this to him and we showed them that he had a problem and he ignored us. I reached out through my state senator. I said, "Would you please set up an audience with Josh Call?" Josh Call 10 times ignored us. So finally I said, if he's going to ignore us here, let's see if he's going to ignore us with the New York Times. So I took out a double trunk ad. And believe me, ads in the New York Times full page running nationally are not cheap. But you know what else was really important is that everything that I wrote in that ad had to be double and triple checked by the legal team at the New York Times. And you know what? They didn't tell me to take out one word. And that shows you, when I can clear the legal teams at the New York Times about the authenticity of what we claim, that shows you exactly how good our data is. And so I got to a point where I asked the governor. I asked the governor, I said, "What are you going to do here? You got an attorney general that's not doing anything." And so Tony Evers, chief legal counsel, Niles Nassusen, wrote on November 16, 2021, that we should bring this matter up in front of the Crimes Victim Rights Board under Marcy's Law. And that's what we did. And what we're doing is we're saying that I'm a victim of a crime. It wasn't the shooting of Michael that's the victim of a crime. It was the cover-up that's occurring and still continuing now that makes me a victim of this crime.
But didn't that Victims' Rights Board rule that if there were a cover-up, it was a cover-up for the state of Wisconsin, not for you personally?
It said that The government was the victim and not us, and nobody could understand that ruling. Everybody's scratching their head over it, and that's why we're bringing this forward. A local judge up in Green Bay was able to toss it on a technicality. I have a very brilliant retired police detective on my team. His name is Russ Beckman. And Russ Beckman filed a complaint with the Crimes Victim Rights Board. He followed their instructions to a T, and then they dismissed and said, you didn't serve it properly. Within a week after we pointed out their instructions, they rewrote the instructions different for everybody else. And so right now it's being held up on a technicality, and that appeal is regarding that technicality.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Let me continue to make a general push here. We've gone so far, we can bring this thing to the goal line.
Michael Bell reveals why he continues looking for the truth more than 20 years after the killing of his son by Kenosha police.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Michael Bell, whose son was killed by Kenosha police in 2004. Your son died in November of 2004. It's been well over 20 years. Since then, you did win a civil rights lawsuit. You have changed the law as far as police departments investigating themselves, no longer being allowed in this state and in many others. What is your ultimate goal? I'm sure some people have said to you, Michael, why are you still doing this after all these years?
Well, you know, this is a great cost. It affects your family and those types of things. I will honestly say that I had reached some points where I had to pull back, that I could not push anymore. But the team that's around me, primarily that investigator from Kenosha, he said, let me continue to make a general push here. We've gone so far, we can bring this thing to the goal line. And we can show exactly what happened. You know, what happened here is very similar to what happened in Minneapolis just 3 or 4 months ago with the shootings that occurred up there with two citizens. You know, they made statements, there were rushes of judgment, there was character assassination. And so even though we changed the law here at the federal level, they did exactly what the Kenosha police officers did in 2004. I have a daughter that witnessed this shooting, and she has to live with that her entire life. Mom has already passed away. She passed away at a very young age, 64. And we all know that she died of a broken heart. And this is a personal victory for me, and this will be a personal victory for people like Renee Good up in Minneapolis and all the other families that had an inappropriate death, and the process wasn't changed. I don't know if you know that I called for an NTSB-style investigation on police shootings. Like, what went wrong? Like in my son's case, we had a jacket gap, and somebody accidentally hooked it on a car mirror. Shouldn't we change that utility belt so it doesn't happen again? Because that's what happens in aviation. And so those are some of the things that I'm looking for here.
Is there ever a time that you see that you'll be able to close your eyes and walk away from all this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. On a personal growth type thing, this was an immense journey. Even though I lost a son and I'm very sad about it, but as a human in my own personal growth, it was so rewarding because it pushed boundaries. You know what kind of courage it takes to take out a double trunk ad in the New York Times? I literally laid in bed at night and shook with fear because I was exposing myself so broadly to anybody that wanted to attack me over it, and it didn't occur. And you have to wonder why. If Bell was wrong, why is he calling him out nationally? Are they ignoring him?
Do you expect at any point that any of those individuals who were involved in this, many of whom are old now, they're out of office, they really don't have anything to lose by reaching out to you. Do you expect to hear from them and have them ever say, look, Michael, this is what really happened?
I do expect it. I see it happening in other cases. There was a civil rights shooting down, I think it was Louisiana, and the officer finally, you know, 45 years later came out. He served a 6-month sentence. He agreed to it, and he told the truth. I expect that to happen. I do want to say that I am pro-law enforcement, and I do support law enforcement. They have an extremely difficult job, and sometimes they don't get the credit that they're due, and that side is suffering too. The officer that killed my son has to live with possibly the guilt of what he has done for his entire life and a mistake that happened. The officer that screamed, "He has my gun," who probably hooked it on a car mirror, as we believe. He committed suicide in October of 2010. And his children had to grow up without a father. His wife had to go on without a husband. So there's a lot of tragedy on all sides here. And so I sympathize with law enforcement. And I've gone to a number of law enforcement funerals where I've seen law enforcement officers grieving over their fallen partner. And so I think something good's going to come out of this.
Michael Bell, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Michael Bell about his quest for justice in the shooting of his son in 2004 by Kenosha police. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Michael, go to WTMJ.com, where you'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. And we've also posted a link to Michael Bell's website. Next week, we talk with a Kenosha police officer who shot and killed Michael Bell Jr. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.